loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Venezuela's right-wing opposition carried out an illegal plebiscite on Sunday while the government held a dry run for the upcoming constituent assembly election for July 30th. The opposition vote included several questions, including one to authorize a military coup d'etat against President Nicolas Maduro. And now the opposition is planning a general strike in an effort to shut down the country on Thursday. Ahead of a high-level diplomatic meeting in Washington, D.C., Russia has rejected any preconditions for the return of its diplomatic compounds that were seized in the last days of the Obama administration. Where are U.S.-Russia relations headed? Is French President Emmanuel Macron looking to exploit Britain's departure from the European Union to weaken its financial sector? As negotiations resume this week, it's France that has taken the most aggressive position towards the UK. But first, we turn to Venezuela. We are joined from London by Francisco Dominguez. He is a professor of Latin American Studies at Middlesex University, where he is also the head of the Center for Brazilian and Latin American Studies. Welcome back, Francisco.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
From the hallowed halls of that most famous democratic institution, the U.S. Senate, Senator Marco Rubio spoke last week denouncing Venezuela's government's effort to have a vote, a democratic vote for a constituent assembly. Francisco, before we get started, I want to play a short audio clip from Marco Rubio on the floor of the U.S. Senate.
And it's now reached what I believe is a tipping point. Later this month, Venezuela's government, I should say executive branch, under its current president, has scheduled an unconstitutional assembly, what they call a constituent assembly. It violates the very constitution of the country. Not to mention that a Supreme Court has already kind of canceled the democratic order. This adds to that. And I just say this with deep sadness. If that goes forward, I think it fundamentally changes this permanently.
Well, now we know Marco Rubio would be deeply sad if the referendum goes forward. I mean, not the referendum, the Constituent Assembly. How did Marco Rubio, Francisco, become an expert on constitutional law in Venezuela? Is he right?
I think he's totally wrong. Article 348 of the Constitution makes it totally clear, actually 347, 348, 349, and 350 are the package, if you like, within the 1999 Constitution that allows, makes provision for this, for the Constitutional Assembly. And the president, according to Article 348, can initiate it. It's totally within the Constitution, absolutely no problem at all. And the only thing they require is that the government actually issues a decree stating it, allowing everybody to participate in a secret ballot to vote in the referendum, in the Constitutional Assembly vote, then define what the election basis of the members of the Constitutional Assembly is going to be. All of this has been done exactly according to the existing constitutional provisions to the letter. So I don't know where Marco Rubio knows that this is unconstitutional. I think he knows it. I think it's just propaganda, which is in tune with the rest of the international media propaganda.
Tell us about the two processes that took place in Venezuela yesterday on Sunday. The opposition held an unofficial plebiscite while the government of President Nicolas Maduro moved ahead with a dry run for the July 20th Constituent Assembly vote. What were the turnouts like? What did you learn from yesterday?
Well, I followed the whole thing from the very beginning, all the way up to about 3 o'clock in the morning, just to make sure that I got very well, you know, informed about it. And it was totally clear. In fact, a dry run has to be done according to law for every election. This is nothing special regarding the dry run that was run yesterday by the government. It's nothing special regarding the Constituent Assembly election on the 30th of July. It is mandatory. They have to do it. And they have done it for every single election. And the basic idea of that is it doesn't produce numbers in the sense that, you know, who got more. The question is to make sure that the system works, it functions, and also to identify any possible technical or other problems that have been, you know, that can come up. However, having said all of that, yesterday the number of people that turned up absolutely exceeding the National Electoral Council and the government expectations. Literally throughout the nation, people were very enthused. I think because they've been mobilized for about a month, several months now, about this. And the reason that mobilized them so much is because they want to have the power, which they know they're going to get with the Constituent Assembly, to actually address the economic problems of the nation, which are caused by the economic war. And secondly, they want peace. They want to have the power to stop the violence that is being perpetrated by the opposition. And, you know, one of the, I think it was Jorge Rodriguez, who is the manager of one of the key people in the Socialist Party of Venezuela, he told an anecdote. He went to a particular polling station and told some old ladies there that have been waiting for hours, you know, to vote. And he said, look, you don't need to vote, really, because already we proved that the system actually worked in this particular constituency. So don't worry, go home, come back on the 30th. And she told him, more or less off, I want to be here because I want to vote. And this is the reason, you know, for as long as I need to be here, I'm going to wait. There were polling stations around the country that stayed open all the way up to 10, 11, and even 12 in the evening. That was the level of the number of people that actually voted. Compared to that, to the plebiscite, I mean, you can check this, you know, with pictures, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of photographs taken by everybody, everywhere, all around the country. On the other hand, I look very much for similar pictures from the plebiscite, and actually I couldn't find too many. There were one or two videotapes of some people. I mean, you know, the opposition has some support. But there is no way that they mobilize as many people as they say. But the key thing is this. The plebiscite is not in the Constitution. There is no provision for a plebiscite in the Venezuelan Constitution. In fact, one of the key people in the government said plebiscites are usually mechanisms that are used by dictators such as, you know, Francisco Franco and Augusto Pinochet and the like. And this is not what we want. We want people to actually participate in the process. That's number one. Number two, it was illegal. They shouldn't have done it. It shows the amount of tolerance that the government has in order to avoid complications with the key process of the Constituent Assembly election and dry run yesterday. The government allowed it without complicating it. Number three, it wasn't done legally through the National Electoral Council, which is what every single electoral process should be done, so that actually there is an arbiter who says, this is the number of people who voted, and, you know, these are the figures of the outcome. This is not the case. And number three, there were no electoral registers for it, none. And many people from the opposition were asked by journalists again and again and again throughout the, from last week all the way up to now, as to whether people, there was any possibility that people vote twice, three times, four times or more. And one of them said, well, it is possible people actually enthusiastically vote more than once, but we trust their good faith that they're not going to do this. And Jorge Rodriguez, one of the key persons in the Socialist Party, said that they have videotape they're going to release soon, that one lady, after the many that they actually checked possibly, voted apparently 15 times. Somebody else voted four times and so on. And all of these without actually anybody who is competent in the sense of being accepted by all the parties to verify the vote. Worse, all the electoral material of the plebiscite is going to be burned. It's already being burned by them, and it's going to be burned completely. So there's not going to be any evidence whatsoever of any kind to corroborate any figure that they come up with. So therefore, the figure that they come up with, which is in the region of 7 million, is absolutely fake.
We're speaking with Francisco Dominguez. We're talking to Francisco from London. He's a professor of Latin American Studies at Middlesex University, where he is also the head of the Center for Brazilian and Latin American Studies. We're talking about the fact that the right-wing opposition in Venezuela went forward yesterday with a non-legal, non-constitutional plebiscite to show opposition to the existing government, the Nicolas Maduro government. The opposition said they were going to burn the results so that the government could not get their hands on the data so that people who voted against Maduro would not be incriminated. But of course, that makes it impossible to verify what they say about the election. Now, Francisco, I just want to emphasize for our audience, the people who came out in the government-sponsored dry run for the Constituent Assembly election, which will take place on July 30th, they weren't really voting. In other words, it wasn't the real thing. It is a dry run. And yet this dry run had so many participants that the polling places actually had to extend their stay, which would be a clear indicator that the Maduro government has vast support internally, something you would never, ever, ever think if you are getting your news from CNN or BBC or the Western corporate-owned media. The BBC had an article up this morning on the results of the headline. Well, before I read the headline, I just want to tell for our American audiences, we all know that it's hard to get even 50% of the people in the United States to vote on election day, not talking about a dry run. But that aside, it's remarkable that they had to extend the polling places for a vote, which was a dry run. But here's the BBC. Venezuela referendum, big show of support for the opposition. CNBC with the headline. Venezuela opposition plans 0 hour after big anti-Maduro vote. The reader might think that this country is overwhelmingly against the government, the Venezuelan government. Is that true? Obviously, we know from what yesterday it's not true. But why are these headlines so, if it's not true, so incredibly misleading?
If you look at it mathematically, somebody's done a mathematical analysis. If I can talk about that very briefly. If you actually have a polling station open 12 hours, which is from 8 in the morning to 8 in the evening, which is more or less the normal practice, and if you have one single place rather than two or three places for people to vote, let's say one, which is the case of most of the polling stations of the opposition yesterday, which was a total of 2,430, if everything goes absolutely according to plan, one person takes 1 minute to vote, then in 12 hours, you're able to actually process 720 people. If you are generous and say, okay, let's imagine that they have two or three, actually that allows you to process something like 1,600. If you multiply that generous number, accepting there is 1 minute, which never is, on the 12 hours shift of the polling station, even with that generosity included, the total maximum number of votes that they could actually get will be 4 million. So it is an absolute mathematical impossibility that this is the case. I think they got much less than that. Already some members of the opposition, such as Emilio Ramos Alupsa, say, you know, let's not get crazy about this, because all we're going to do is to actually raise false expectations. I think the international media are just coming to their rescue to try to suggest that actually it was a success for them when everybody knows it was a very significant failure. And they have two options now, and this is part of the problem. I suppose, you know, the media is being mobilized from Washington somehow to maintain a hard line, try to persuade those who are wavering for going for the option of violence to actually go back to that position. Because they have two options, the opposition. Either they come to the negotiation table and the dialogue table. Maduro again called them to actually to come to the negotiating table, to engage in dialogue, to stop the violence and, you know, take the process forward. And some others, you know, will have to go for violence because they're a bit desperate. Because what do they do after this? Their plebiscite is non-binding. It doesn't mean anything. They know they haven't got enough votes as they claim they did. this information, which already I'm given, is going to start, you know, emerging from all over the place. And what do they do between now and the 30s? They cannot appear. I think they might, but they cannot appear as, you know, organizing violence to stop people from voting. That would be against democracy and against the constitutional provision, which is the Constitutional Assembly. And given the level of support that the Constitutional Assembly had, you know, they are in real trouble. I think that's the reason why the international media actually are trying to save their backsides, to put it very bluntly. We'll see what happens. I mean, you know, it will depend very much about what Washington designs regarding the situation in Venezuela. I don't think the whole of the U.S. establishment actually shares necessarily in this particular point Marco Rubio's hard line, but you never know. Given that they actually pay the money and fund the opposition, they might actually call the tune. So we have to wait and see. The only thing we can do at the moment from here, you know, all good people around the world, is to defend the democratic right of the people of Venezuela to vote.
Jimmy Carter, I believe, and other international experts have praised Venezuela's voting procedure. I think Jimmy Carter said it was the best in the world. Am I remembering that right?
He said it was the best electoral system in the world. And the context was, he said, as my center has monitored and observed 92 electoral processes around the world, and this is the best there is as far as that is concerned. That's the context.
And when the PSUV, the Socialist Party, Maduro's party, lost the parliamentary election, they've won most of the elections over the past 18, 17 years. But when they lost the election and they lost pretty badly in the last parliamentary election, unlike the opposition, which never recognizes the legitimacy of these elections, which Jimmy Carter said was the best electoral system of the 92 he's monitored, the Maduro government recognized and accepted its defeat. In other words, they didn't say, oh, that was a rigged election, that was voter fraud. They accepted it. In other words, again, the media is the problem, I think, Francisco, one problem in the United States, because the people are really told, and almost, it's not brainwashing, that's more precise, but it's kind of like brainwashing, where people are convinced that the Maduro government is anti-democratic, won't allow democratic procedures to go forward, is violent against peaceful protesters, and the protesters represent the vast, maybe 95% of the population, and they're peaceful, and they're being shut down, and then they have sort of those constitutional law experts like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, who not only were describing Venezuela as at a tipping point, in other words, insinuating that civil war was on the horizon, but actually telling Venezuelans to go participate in an illegal, informal plebiscite by the opposition, which then can say, well, this is the zero hour. In other words, is the right wing, because of its diminished support against even all the media images, because of its diminished support, are they preparing for a real sort of civil war type scenario? And as you're suggesting, that depends to a large degree on what the paymasters in Washington actually want under these circumstances. We have about 2 minutes left.
Yeah, you have crazies in the Venezuelan opposition as well. Not only have extreme right wingers and right wingers, they have crazies who are just prepared to go for broke. One never knows what they're going to do. They might go for something else, for something crazy. You remember they used an helicopter to launch a terrorist attack against two ministries and the Supreme Court. So one never knows. I think there are crazies in Washington as well, in the State Department and other places. God knows what they can do. The difficulty they have is this. Rex Tillerson, as possibly you know, went to Spain to talk to the Popular Party government, talk to the foreign minister and ask him for support for sanctions from the European Union against Venezuela. And the foreign minister of Spain told him, no, we are not prepared to do that. So it seems to me that they are becoming isolated. So the key from the point of view of the media is to actually get to Europe. Nothing legitimizes U.S. foreign policy regarding the Middle East, regarding Africa, regarding Latin America, than the support that normally get from the European Union. If there is any distinction, any divide on that, the United States will be pretty isolated, and the only weapon they have is the media. And, you know, the media responds pretty much to the State Department. It seems to me on many occasions regarding Venezuela, the position adopted by the media, the BBC, CNN, the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and so on, is indistinguishable from that the position of the State Department. And it seems to me that now the opposition are possibly going to go through some crisis, because whatever they claim, which is, you know, fake and phony, regarding the number of votes, which everybody in Venezuela knows this is not true. Whatever people may believe outside Venezuela, inside they have to actually take a stock of the situation. Already Vicente de León, leader of the quite respected poster, but right-wing poster called That Analysis, you know, more or less, I mean, he didn't use these words, but he said that claim is a bit of a he said. And he said, you know, let's calm down because this is not true. You're not going to actually put forward the idea that you just defeated the government and are ready to take power and, you know, go for broke, which is not possible. And it seems to me that that's the dilemma. So it will depend very much on what Washington wants to do with the Venezuelan opposition. The good thing is that the Venezuelan good side of it is so strong now, it's strengthened massively, it makes it more difficult for such external interference and intervention. Although, as you know, anything is possible.
Yeah, I just, in my final word here, the Washington Post ran an amazing headline last week. The headline was something like, "Pilot who led helicopter protests participates in political rally." And it took the seventh paragraph to find out that the guy hijacked a helicopter and carried out an armed attack from the air against the Supreme Court. You don't find that out from the Washington Post till the seventh paragraph. It's just called a protest, a helicopter protest. Well, in the United States, in Washington, D.C., if you go leaflet and stand on the stairs of the Supreme Court, you will be arrested. You don't have to drop hand grenades from a helicopter as he did. In other words, amazingly bigoted media coverage. Anyway, we are out of time. We've been joined from London by Francisco Dominguez. He is a professor of Latin American Studies at Middlesex University, where he is the head of the Center for Brazilian and Latin American Studies. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Ahead of a high-level diplomatic meeting in Washington, D.C. today, Russia has rejected any preconditions for the return of its two diplomatic compounds in New York and Maryland that were seized in the last days of the Obama administration when President Obama also expelled 35 Russian diplomats. Where are U.S.-Russian relations headed? We are joined from New York City by Daniel Lazar. He is a journalist and the author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Welcome, Daniel. Daniel, before we begin, I want to play a short clip. It's from RT. It was broadcast on December 30th, the day after President Obama expelled 35 Russian diplomats and seized or announced the seizure of two Russian compounds. Putin's responding to the Obama administration's seizure. And let's just listen to what he said, because it sort of set the tone. It was a bit of a surprise. And then I want to get your reaction.
The Russian leader says it's not the time for such unfriendly relations, retaliatory actions, even though such a response would have been warranted.
We reserve the right for tit-for-tat measures, but we won't stoop to kitchen diplomacy. We'll plan our next steps to restore Russian-U.S. relations based on policy, which the new administration of Donald Trump will pursue. We won't create hurdles for American diplomats. We won't expel anyone.
As you know, Daniel tweeted how happy he was that Putin had not retaliated. Of course, Mike Flynn was talking to the Russians around that time. There was a lot of speculation about whether they were talking about what the Russian response would be to the Obama administration's decision to expel 35 diplomats and seize these two diplomatic compounds. Nonetheless, here we are in July 2017. Donald Trump has been president for 6 months. The U.S. hasn't done anything to change their status. So talk about it and talk about the big picture, if you would.
Well, I mean, all hell has broken loose in the last 6 months. Donald Trump walked into a buzzsaw in Washington. Washington exploded over any suggestion of an alteration in U.S.-Russian relations. Trump was thrown on the defensive immediately. There was an absolutely unprecedented press campaign, a furious, wide-ranging press campaign to sort of beat him into submission. And as a consequence, things have stalled. Nothing's happened.
What about the issue of preconditions? It appeared that the Trump administration was, even back in May when the Washington Post reported that the Trump administration was considering returning the two compounds to Russia. Now Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, has said that would be like daylight robbery. These are our compounds. They belong to us as a consequence of the fact that we purchased them and by bilateral agreements that were ratified between Russia and the United States. The United States was also allowed to have compounds in Russia. So now trying to sort of use this as a bargaining chip to get more is automatically rejected. The Russians say, no, we're not going to do that.
It's amazingly petty, but frankly, I'll go out on a limb here, and I don't think those compounds will be returned. Because if they were, there'd be a storm, an absolute storm. It's crazy, it's amazingly petty, but I think a storm will erupt in the United States if Trump moves to return those properties.
Okay, so there wasn't much more, this is the Russian view, I think, there wasn't much more President Obama could do on his way out of office to worsen relations between U.S. and Russia. The Obama administration said that U.S. intelligence agencies had agreed, or at least had a high degree of confidence, no hard evidence was actually provided and still has not been provided, showing that Russia directly intervened in the U.S. elections, trying to tilt the election, perhaps to undermine democracy, maybe to favor the election of Donald Trump. But the Russians didn't retaliate. Do you think at this point, if it doesn't come back, I mean, don't they sort of at a certain point have to decide, well, you can't just seize our compounds, we will do the same, and then what happens?
Well, there are various face-saving measures that either side could engage in, that the Russians have blocked the U.S. from constructing a consulate, I believe, in St. Petersburg. So there are various things that can be done to try to smooth things out. But you just got to recognize that Donald Trump is not really totally in control. He is fighting he's fighting trench warfare with a Democratic, neocon, liberal press, et cetera, which is dead set against any kind of a compromise with the Russians. In fact, if anything, its stance is hardening. And Trump, so far, has been very limited in his ability to beat back that offensive.
We're speaking with Daniel Lazare. He is a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking about the meeting that's taking place right now as we speak between the Russian government and the U.S. government about the possible return to Russia of two diplomatic compounds, one in New York, one in Maryland, that were seized at the same time President Obama on December 29th expelled 35 Russian diplomats on the basis of, well, as for retaliation for what he said was Russia's meddling in the U.S. election. Okay, so Daniel, when President Obama came into office in 2009, he said he wanted to have better relations with Russia. Hillary Clinton went and met with Lavrov, then foreign minister, still foreign minister. She brought him that great big red reset button. It had a bad Russian translation, so it didn't really translate into reset. So the Russians were a little bit confused for a moment. But anyway, it was like, that's not so unusual. Let's have better relations with Russia, the other largest thermonuclear power in the world. But here you have 8 years later, the Democrats, as you're saying, it would be almost kind of political suicide or certainly walking the gangplank if the Trump administration just did this thing, return two compounds that belong to Russia. What, in your opinion, accounts for the change in the last 8 years? Is it domestic politics right now? The Democrats, having lost the election, won't let it go, are blaming Trump, blaming the Russians for Trump's victory? Or is there something else that's more profound?
Well, it's really both. I mean, the Democrats won't let go. They're fighting tooth and nail against any kind of stabilization on the part of the Trump administration. But there are domestic concerns, but there are also larger, you know, foreign policy concerns. I mean, essentially, Hillary Clinton wanted good relations with Russia on America's terms. And that didn't really quite work out because beginning in 2011 to 2014, U.S. foreign policy really took a disastrous turn. Things just lost control, most especially in the Middle East, but also in Eastern Europe and the Ukraine. And this is due largely to the amazingly provocative actions by Hillary Clinton, who organized NATO interventions in Libya and a Gulf state intervention in Syria that had catastrophic consequences, and also backed a popular uprising / coup d'etat in the Ukraine, which also had disastrous consequences. Now, the U.S. Really had overextended itself, and as a consequence, it found that it had lost control. And that Putin, who is whatever you want to say about the guy, is obviously a very clever chess player, was able to take advantage of. And so, therefore, the U.S. is deeply, deeply angry. This is the world hegemon, and it doesn't pay to anger the world hegemon. So the U.S. is fighting to regain its lost clout, and it is up in arms over any attempt by Putin to carve out any kind of concession in the Middle East or the Ukraine. And therefore, it's growing more aggressive rather than less. I think it's a highly dangerous moment.
Let's go back again, because it's such a big story. It's an important story because, of course, Russian-U.S. relations have been big, and they were big during the Soviet era. They were perhaps the centerpiece of global politics. Now, again, a growing confrontation, in some ways like an unmanaged rivalry. As unlike the Soviet-U.S. confrontation during the Cold War, it developed its own equilibrium. There was summit talks. There was arms deals.
There were also vicious little wars like Vietnam, in which several million people were killed. That was sort of part of the ongoing rivalry.
Yeah. No, I hear you on that. Vietnam, Korea, I mean, millions and millions of people died. But what I'm talking about was, I'm just saying that at a certain point, there established a certain sort of equilibrium in the confrontation once both sides knew that they were mutually assured of their destruction should nuclear war begin. So, but here we're in this other territory. Now, let's go back. Obama gets elected in 2008. He takes office in 2009. He names Secretary of State, names Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. She opposed the sanctions on Russia. She opposed the Magnitsky Act. At the same time, Bill Clinton received, you know, $500,000 from the Renaissance Investment Bank in Russia, which would have been affected by sanctions from the Magnitsky Act. So as late as 2012, you have this Hillary Clinton-led State Department really being the dove side of American relations with Russia, and then suddenly she shifts. Is it because of Syria? Is it because of Ukraine? Or was it because of the politicking, the reorientation of Clinton as she prepared to be a presidential candidate? What's your view on that?
I think it's the former. I think that in Libya and Syria, 2012 was really the disastrous year. I mean, Libya collapsed and Syria collapsed in civil war. And the U.S. suddenly found that it had a huge problem on its hands, one it hadn't really prepared for. And the same thing happened a year later in the Ukraine, where the where demonstrations broke out in Kiev. And by the end of the year, in 2013, that regime was tottering as well, with unforeseen consequences for the U.S. So the U.S. found itself, on one hand, it was extremely aggressive under Clinton, moved very aggressively in the Middle East, in Syria and Libya, and in Ukraine, but then very quickly found that it was losing control by virtue of its very aggressiveness. It found itself thrown back on the defensive, and then it found itself losing the advantage to another party. So Clinton was still in her magnanimous stage in 2012, when everything was going swimmingly, and it looked like the United States was, you know, was remodeling the Middle East in its own image. So it could afford to be generous. But then that rapidly changed as the year wore on, and 2012 grew into 2013, and suddenly things were spinning out of control all over the place.
And just for our audience, the Russians in 2011 went along with the U.S. and others, U.N. Resolution 1973 that allowed the authorized the use of military force to protect civilians in Libya. Like, Russia could have vetoed that. They did not, nor did China. Obviously, it would have been, from my point of view, a smart thing to have done, but that was not what was done. They abstained. So, but then the U.S. went ahead and carried out a merciless bombing, clearly not to just defend civilians, if it was ever that, but to carry out regime change until Gaddafi is actually lynched in the streets, to which Hillary Clinton comes and says, "We came, we saw, he died," laughingly on the day of the lynching of a head of state. I guess you're saying that was perhaps the turning point for Russia.
Well, yes, also for the U.S., but you know, even more important, in April 2011, Hillary Clinton, or actually March, wooed the emir of Qatar to joining the anti-Gaddafi coalition, which Qatar did. But in so doing, he distributed $400 to $500 million to Salafist rebels in Libya who proceeded to tear the country apart. This is well documented. The New York Times did a major takeout on this whole question about 6 months ago. And so it was the U.S. policies which really directly helped wreck that country and which caused, you know, fright and alarm in Russia, especially when Hillary Clinton, you know, forgetting nothing and learning nothing, proceeded to do the same thing in Syria. So that's when Russia was forced to take action to stabilize the situation. I know I'm coming off as a Putin apologist, but nonetheless, I do believe American behavior at this time was such an amazing combination of aggressiveness and incompetence that I was stunned watching it, and I'm still stunned today at the inability of the U.S. to admit that there was in any way in error.
Well, and of course, Daniel Lazar, you're not a Putin apologist. But, you know, that's the thing about a witch hunt or a kind of hysteria. Everybody kind of has to say something like that. You're actually just telling the truth about what the U.S. did in the Middle East. And I agree with you completely about what caused what. And I certainly think that the destruction of the Libyan government and then the rapid sort of unthinking hubris that drove American policy to do the same in Syria, a longtime Russian ally, and also very much a center of things in the Middle East and in the Arab world was of decisive importance. And then 2 years later comes Ukraine. But anyway, I want to come back to the compound issue. When the Russian government decided not to retaliate for the closure of the compounds, Trump tweeted on December 30th, the next day, quote, "Great move on delay, paren, by V. Putin, paren. I always knew he was very smart." Then Trump tweeted on July 9th, just last week, about his meeting with Putin. He finally met him on the sidelines of the G20. "Sanctions were not discussed at my meeting with President Putin. Nothing will be done until the Ukrainian and Syrian problems are solved." Yet at the G20 meeting, there was a ceasefire agreement reached for the southwestern part of Syria. Anyway, last month, the Russian foreign ministry spokeswoman said it's best to immediately return our property. Otherwise, Russia has the right to come up with a tit-for-tat response in retaliation to American property in Russia. I want to confirm that the retaliatory measures are in the works. So here you have it. 6 months later, great move by Putin. He didn't retaliate, but 6 months later, the United States refused to return these compounds. I know you don't have a crystal ball. You think Russia is about to retaliate if nothing happens?
I think yes. I think that first of all, nothing will happen. I think that Trump really can't return these properties without setting off a huge forest fire in Washington, and that he'll be forced not to do a deal. And then Russia will eventually be forced to take retaliatory measures. I mean, I think it was Putin said, you know, his patience is not inexhaustible. So no country can put up this kind of provocation forever, this kind of undiplomatic provocation. So Russia, I think, will be forced to take action. I could be wrong, of course. I have been in the past, but that's my best prediction.
I only ask guests now to make predictions because I stopped making them after November 8th. That was just too embarrassing. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman also said on Friday, there are too many employees of the CIA and the Pentagon's espionage unit working under the roof of the American diplomatic mission whose activity does not correspond at all with their status. Again, that sounds pretty much to me like the Russian Foreign Ministry is at least is signaling Trump and the U.S. government that they must do something and do something soon about the two compounds, which Russia denies were intelligence compounds. Maybe all things associated with diplomacy are intelligence in one way or the other. But it seems to me like if the United States doesn't do anything, and you're saying, Daniel Lazare, that you feel Trump is so boxed in that even if he would want to, he just won't do it because the political cost will be too high, that we're going to go into the next stage of Russian-U.S. confrontation, because once Russia does that, even Trump's critics, no matter what Trump does in response, will take that as a new provocation or a new aggression from Russia. I think given the tempo and the tenure and the attitude of what's going on in Washington, I think that's what's likely.
I'm very pessimistic myself. I think that the confrontation is building. The Democrats and neocons and intelligence agencies and press are pushing for it in the most irresponsible manner possible. And I can't see any way out. I just see a deepening confrontation, especially in the Middle East, but maybe in the Ukraine also.
And the other thing that's so noteworthy is that Donald Trump's policies, which are so regressive and reactionary, xenophobic, anti-Muslim, anti-woman, racist, I mean, there's so many reasons to protest and be against Donald Trump, and people have been. But the Democratic Party has focused almost exclusively, it seems to me, on this. And as a consequence, the liberal anti-Trump opposition seems to be just in some ways lining up behind what is fundamentally a reactionary, very, very reactionary foreign policy orientation of the liberals. I mean, the liberals, the Democratic Party, not that it's really liberal, they sound like the Republicans under Ronald Reagan to me. Go ahead. We have 1 minute left.
America has two right-wing parties. That's essential, yes. I mean, the Democrats are to the right on foreign policy, and Trump is to the right on domestic policy. So it's a race to the bottom. I mean, the bird of state is slapping in a reactionary direction, and both wings, the left wing and the right wing, are aiding in this flight. And, the trajectory seems clear. The situation in Syria, I think, will only get worse. You have the showdown between Saudi Arabia and Iran and Qatar and Iran, which I think can only get worse. The whole thing just seems to be veering out of control.
All right. We're out of time. We've been joined from New York by Daniel Lazare. He is a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Thank you, Daniel, for joining us. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Is French President Emmanuel Macron looking to exploit Britain's departure from the European Union to weaken its financial sector? As negotiations resume this week, it's France that has taken the most aggressive position towards and perhaps against the UK. We are joined from London by independent journalist Steve Topple. Welcome back, Steve.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with an audio clip from a speech that Theresa May made in March at the House of Commons, announcing that she was officially beginning the Brexit process. She sounds pretty confident back then, but I'm just thinking she might be feeling a little bit different now. But let's hear the British Prime Minister, Theresa May.
The Article 50 process is now underway, and in accordance with the wishes of the British people, the United Kingdom is leaving the European Union. This is an historic moment from which there can be no turning back. Britain is leaving the European Union. We are going to make our own decisions and our own laws. We are going to take control of the things that matter most to us. And we are going to take this opportunity to build a stronger, fairer Britain, a country that our children and grandchildren are proud to call home. That is our ambition and our opportunity. And that is what this government is determined to do.
All right. So Theresa May, back in March, before she had such a disastrous election with Jeremy Corbyn, she was, I guess, making the UK great again. Steve, we Americans know about that.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, Theresa May seemed extremely confident in the run-up to the general election. She, I think, believed that she had the will of the British people behind her regarding Brexit, and she quite often spoke about this phrase she repeatedly coined, Brexit means Brexit, is essentially that she would be going for what's known over here as a hard Brexit. However, obviously, the general election threw those plans into chaos for her. She was expecting a majority. Some people were predicting the majority of 100 seats. She actually lost seats, as we know, and went down to 316, which is a minority in this country. And I think with that went the whole notion somehow that the country as a whole backed her plans for Brexit. I mean, the latest opinion polling now shows that the majority of the public, I think it was 53%, now want a referendum on the actual terms of Brexit once the two-year process of triggering of Article 50 is concluded. So things have changed drastically for Theresa May over here at the moment.
Former British Foreign Minister, Foreign Officer, Office Minister Jeremy Brown said in a memorandum that was leaked by the Mail on Sunday about France's approach to Brexit, quote, "They are crystal clear about their underlying objective, the weakening of Britain, the ongoing degradation of the City of London. The meeting with the French Central Bank was the worst I have had anywhere in the EU. They are in favor of the hardest Brexit. They want disruption. They actively seek disaggregation of financial services provisions." What do you make of his comments? Is France using Britain's exit from the EU to weaken Britain's hold as in London, the financial center? Is it trying to move it to Paris? What's going on?
Absolutely. I mean, it's fascinating looking into this because Jeremy Brown also said that France wants Britain's position weakened by Brexit, even if it means that business from the financial services industry doesn't even go to Paris. They don't seem bothered about that. They seem to want to hit Britain where it hurts, if you like. Now, obviously, I mean, this is problematic for Theresa May. The financial services industry in this country produces around 12% of total GDP. It has a trade surplus of around £72 billion a year. It contributes, I think it's 11% of the country's tax take, and also employs about 2 million people. So this is going to be extremely problematic for Theresa May. And what it's going to do, I believe, is add this pressure onto her that part of the Brexit deal should be that the UK stays in the single market. Because what the threats around Brexit in the City of London have always been is that the challenge for the financial service industry is that it's going to lose what are called passporting rights, whereby financial institutions can trade across the EU without having to worry about any financial or economic barriers, if you like. Now, leaving the single market, they will lose that, and they will have to set up capitalized subsidiaries in every single country they now want to trade with. But if Brexit involves staying in the single market, then those fears will be alleviated. So there's a real sort of debate happening in this country at the minute about whether Brexit should mean that we leave the single market or not. And I think this is going to add weight, in some respects, to the argument that we should really remain part of the single market.
Okay, again, for the American audience, Steve Topol, which knows nothing about European politics, more or less, and nothing about the single market, just break it down. What are you talking about? Like, what's the difference between being part of the single market and being outside of it? And how will it impact not only Britain, but the other countries in the Western, certainly the Western part of Europe?
Okay, so in layman's terms, the single market is a free trade area. It's a bit like your North American, it's NAFTA, isn't it? It's kind of like that. It's a free trade area where there are no financial penalties, no regulations, if you like, surrounding trades that are country by country. It's the 28 European member states have open borders regarding trade. There are no tariffs involved, if you like, and trade can come and go as it pleases. However, what it also means, and what was one of the arguments surrounding Brexit from people who wanted to leave the European Union, is that this free trade area means that Brussels, the centre of the EU, basically sets all the laws surrounding trade as well. So we were being governed regarding our buying and selling of products by people in Brussels and not by our own Parliament of Westminster. So, yeah, it's basically one big free trade area. And if Britain leaves that, then financial penalties will be imposed, trade tariffs will come into play. So hence why I think this stance by the French, as it stands at the minute, will add weight, like I said, the argument that we should remain part of the single market, the free trade area.
I'm reading from a New York Times article that was post-Brexit, and this was in not too long ago, in May 2017, speculating what would happen for the dominance of British banks, the London financial sector, which, as you mentioned, has a great impact on the larger UK and English economy. This is how the article starts. From a skyscraper in Canary Wharf, the once bustling cluster of docks transformed into a global banking center. Traders at Citigroup's regional headquarters move unfathomable sums of money around the planet. They are exploiting London's unrivaled connection to the intricate plumbing of the international financing system. Now the flow of money is in doubt, imperiling London's fortunes. Now, Steve, the people in London voted to remain in the EU. They, in large measure, were against Brexit. Of course, London is a cosmopolitan city. There's lots of immigrants, a lot of people who are, were not native born to the UK. In other words, it has a different social feel than other parts of the UK, but it also has the financial sector. The financial sector in general was against Brexit, right? They feared this would happen. And if their fears are materialized, will London's banking center go to Paris, or will it go, say, to Brussels, or will it go to Germany? And talk about that, and also, how is Macron, as the new leader in France, viewing all of this and viewing his own role in the larger European political landscape?
Look, I mean, there's a flip side to this argument, if you like, and it is that Theresa May, if she wishes to continue with the hard Brexit, all she will do regarding the financial services industry is make it more appealing to them to stay in London. That is, make regulations even more lax for financial services industries operating in the UK. She'll make the tax incentives greater. And there is also chatter of this as well, that the UK could be turned into this corporate tax haven, if you like, in Theresa May's bids to try and keep the financial services industry in this country. So there's that. She's either going to play it two ways, as I say, single market routes that will stay in that, or she will effectively deregulate the industry even more to ensure that banks stay here. If they did move abroad, I'd say my assessment of it, they probably would go to Germany. I mean, if you look at, there was a fascinating study done several years ago by a university that was published in The New Scientist, which revealed the top 50 corporations in the world, which own the other 47,000 multinational corporations. And many of these companies were actually based in Germany. The 12th biggest corporation in the world was Deutsche Bank, of course. But as well, you have to look at the top of that tree. The biggest corporation in the world is actually Barclays, which is a British bank, a British-based company. But I can't see them going to Paris. I'd say Germany is probably the clearer candidate, if you like, for that. But I just don't think Theresa May is going to let it get that far. Regarding your question about Macron, it's very interesting. I mean, he's been backed, interestingly, by Tony Blair lately, in Tony Blair's arguments that Britain should remain in the European Union, because Macron is quite keen on reform of the EU. Obviously, he's an ex-banker himself, and there's a lot of narrative at the minute about how he wishes to change the EU for the better for the people of France and for everyone within the Union. But he's obviously asserting his authority, because this Jeremy Brown, the Foreign Office Minister, the former Foreign Office Minister we quoted at the start, said that the mood in France had become more giddy and more assertive by the election of President Macron. So it's extremely interesting times. But of course, Brian, we are talking in terms of mainstream conventional politics here. If we want to go sort of to a far left perspective on this, is it any bad thing that the basically nefarious financial services industry gets out of the UK anyway? Some would argue possibly not.
Indeed. Of course, it's two different worlds, those inhabited by bankers and corporate barons and the elites and working people. I got you on that, but I am trying to understand, because what happens at the summits within France, within Germany, within the UK, and how they intertangle has a profound impact on, you know, the future of Europe and the future of each of those countries. I'm not being sort of hyperbolic by mentioning that, of course, World War I and World War II started in Europe and in other competition places of competition between large capitalist states. But the EU was partly, and the UN was partly, designed to try to stop the scourge of inter-capitalist wars between these major powers. It does seem to be, it's not unraveling, but it's certainly fraying around the edges. And again, I just wanted you to talk a little bit about, is it possible that Germany, which of course has been the dominant power in the EU and using France sort of as a junior partner, is France's assertiveness now under Macron and under these circumstances? He just hosted Donald Trump, which in some ways was kind of a surprise. Is he trying to rival Angela Merkel and Germany for real leadership of Europe?
I think there's a real power struggle going on at the minute within the EU. I mean, if you look at both those politicians individually in terms of their own countries, Merkel isn't in the strong position she used to be in Germany with regards to her popularity and the popularity of her party. And of course, Macron has come off the back of, I mean, it's kind of bizarre, really. Macron's come off the back of, if you like, this anti-establishment feeling that we get around the world with the likes of the election of Trump in the US, with what we've seen with Jeremy Corbyn in the UK. That's manifested in France, if you like, with the election of Macron, oddly, who's a completely centrist, if you like, candidate. But of course, it's a rejection of the socialist party of the past few years over there. So I think there's internal power struggles going on within the EU. But more, what's more importantly than that, the project, the divide between the south of the EU and the industrialized north, if you like, it's that divide is not going away, and it's becoming worse. Obviously, we've had the situation in Greece with their massive problems with debt. We've seen the same in Italy, the EU imposing austerity upon them to try and sort out their burgeoning debt crisis. I think the project is shaky as it is, and I think that this was, for many people within the EU hierarchy, the whole problem with Brexit, that it was putting this massive level of undermining, if you like, of the whole notion of the EU. And there was concerns, and I think there is still concerns, that Brexit could be the first domino, if you like, in a rally of countries questioning their whole membership of the EU. I think it's going to be an interesting couple of years, and I think you cannot understate the effect that Brexit is having on the EU as a whole.
Yeah, I agree with you. The right-wing parties, the xenophobic parties, were the ones taking advantage initially of all of this sort of polarization about income inequality and unemployment and underemployment and other issues. Now you have the left also reasserting itself with the surprising success of Corbyn in the general election, and the Labour Party now led by its left wing. In the case of France, Macron won, but against Marine Le Pen, the right wing National Front candidate, but the left was also surprisingly strong there. I mean, if the Socialist Party, the left there, had pulled out, say, in the first round of the French election, Mélenchon, a real leftist, may have been one of the, you know, in the top two in terms of the final runoff. And now we have a situation where I just was reading that the PTB, the Workers' Party of Belgium, has also done surprisingly well in Belgium's parliamentary elections. As we go forward, there's this kind of internecine struggle between the elites within what used to be the EU in France, Germany, Britain, and the divide between North and South. Do you feel that there could be the beginning of something for a left-wing resurgence, as evidenced by what some of these recent electoral contests?
I think there is, yes. I think that, especially as we've seen over here, as you alluded to, the rise of Corbyn. I mean, if you look at what's happened since the general election with Corbyn's Labour Party, they've continued to surge in the polls. The latest opinion polling has put Labour on 45%, 5 points ahead of the Conservative government. Now, this is fairly unprecedented. Labour has never, ever, ever managed to achieve that high score before in the history of this particular polling company. It was YouGov, the biggest polling company in the UK. Labour have never hit that score before. It's quite fascinating to watch. And as you say, we're seeing across Europe, the challenge is that a lot, especially in the UK, a lot of these left-wing parties and left-wing movements, you see it over here with Labour, also with our Green Party over here, they are actually fundamentally pro-EU. Although Corbyn himself is a Eurosceptic, he's always made no bones about the fact that he is. His party's positioning is still trying to negotiate Brexit in the best way possible, and many within the Labour Party are pro-EU, and the Greens are openly pro-EU. So I think, yes, we're seeing a left-wing resurgence. I think, yes, it's going to continue, and I think it's going to put the far right that has been on the rise, if you like, for a few years to bed, to be honest. However, with regards to the EU, I don't think it's going to see an undoing of that project, if you like. I think there is still a feeling amongst the majority of the liberal left that the EU is, despite its faults, an overly good organisation that we're better off being in than being out of.
We're speaking with Steve Topple. He's an independent journalist. We're talking to him from London. We have 2 minutes left, Steve. Former Prime Minister Tony Blair has resurfaced in recent days. He did an interview on BBC Radio in which he alluded to Macron proposing, quote, far-reaching reforms for the EU, something that you were alluding to. He also broke his silence on Jeremy Corbyn's electoral success. Of course, Blair represents New Labour, the elites, the neoliberal conservative capitalist elites, I would say. But he's now saying that Labour was behind Corbyn, quote, for now, close quote. But he warned if Brexit was combined with leaving the single market and, quote, the largest spending program Labour had ever proposed, the country would be in a very serious situation. Last minute and a half, what's your take on all that?
Oh, look, the UK collectively groans whenever Tony Blair resurfaces these days. I never see a good word said about him, and that's from the mainstream media over here, let alone the independent media. Look, I mean, he's like a rat in a sack, if you like. He's basically saying that the country does really still want centrist politics, even though none of the opinion polling and the results of the general election is showing that. He says that Corbyn would still be a disaster for this country. I think he's basically scrabbling around, although he does represent a lot of people in the Labour Party who still have this view that somehow the neoliberal centre is the answer to everything. It's basically capitalists trying to mend capitalism. I think he comes and goes, and I think people largely just mock what he has to say now. Out of touch, out of time, I think.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from London by independent journalist Steve Topple. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day at 5 p.m. at 105.5 FM. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.